The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, another handbrake swerve by the Prime Minister, this time over sentencing. It's goodbye rehabilitation revolution and back to prison works. Also this week, politics in Westminster is often divisive and adversarial, but despite the return to bang-em-up mania, is there a liberal clique at the top of politics that bridges party lines? That's the contention of one of our guests, the former director of Centre Forum and the Lib Dem insider, Julian Astle. A warm welcome to you and a welcome too to our columnists and regular political podsters, Anne Perkins and Madeleine Bunting. The big story of this week then arrived wrapped in a solemn Downing Street press conference and came from a Prime Minister whose hoodie-hugging days are now long behind him.
Our whole approach needs to be built around the recognition that the first duty of government is to protect the public and ensure that those who play by the rules are kept safe. Second, serious and dangerous offenders must go to jail and stay there for a long time. And we must be tougher on confiscating the assets of criminals as well. Third, breaking the cycle of reoffending needs to be right at the heart of the criminal justice system. This requires a completely new approach. It means a much tougher view of prison as a real place of punishment and reform, with a proper focus on addressing the causes of offending, so when prisoners are released, they are much less likely to offend again. And it means those who run prisons or community sentences should be paid according to their success in reducing reoffending at every stage of the criminal justice system, from sentences in the community to prisons and probation.
So, tougher sentences and a tougher time for those who do end up in jail. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor. Alan, what's prompted the latest about turn?
Well, in one sense, it's been the desire of David Cameron to make a speech about crime, which the last 3 or 4 weeks he's finally got round to making, and he finally let his brain mind engage with the question of what the government's policy on crime and particularly sentencing and rehabilitation actually is. And that prompted a series of meetings between Clark and Cameron to sort out what exactly was in his green paper, sentencing proposals on prisons, which would have, in their intention, reduced the prison population by about 6,000 over the next 3 or 4 years, and would have given enough room for his rehabilitation revolution to actually get off the ground and try and attempt to cut reoffending rates. But at first, as we know, ran into trouble over the question of discounts for guilty plea sentences, specifically on the subject of rape, which wasn't well handled by Clark, then has pitched into wider questions now of other elements, public protection sentences and so on, to the extent that Cameron has effectively carved 60% of his package and carved it out and dropped it completely.
And you wrote earlier in the week that there's also the other policies Cameron's come up with on mandatory sentences and stuff that might end up with the prison population now going up rather than down. So where does this leave Ken Clark?
I would say just carrying on. He obviously is almost like a hobby cabinet minister now at the age of 71, isn't he? That he just sort of shrugs his shoulders and said, I think he said in the Commons that one of the problems, he was accused of twisting, I think, over this one. And he said, well, one of the problems of his career was he hadn't perhaps twisted enough over the years, and that's why his career hadn't gone so terribly. I'm not sure he would want to carry on necessarily. And I know that Cameron was quick to rule out a reshuffle. I think maybe in about 5 or 6 months' time, Ken will think, well, what's really the point in soldiering on in this way?
So, Anne, is this another case of David Cameron laying down his friends for his political life?
He does seem to have a bit of form on this, doesn't he? But actually, it's quite interesting listening to that clip, because it seems to me that Cameron has this kind of fantastic kind of PR man's ability to sound like his speeches have been written, certainly his recent speeches have been written by Daily Mail leader writers. But at the same time, he's actually still, you know, there's a good deal less to them than meets the eye. And certainly Alan Travis in his pieces in the paper pointed out, for example, that a lot of the legal changes that he proposed, that, for example, the mandatory prison sentence for using a knife, you know, actually doesn't change policy at all any more than the Tony Martin bash a burglar law, you know, which has been reviewed several times and found to be perfectly adequate as it stands. That's not going to change anything either. So he's very good at the kind of window dressing of all of this. But if he actually genuinely is trying to find a way of delivering, on the old liberal ambitions of a kind of prison system that genuinely reduces reoffending, which means dealing with illiteracy and innumeracy and seriously tackling drug abuse, then, you know, which were the 2 points he kind of particularly raised then maybe the liberal agenda is more intact, less damaged than it originally appeared.
But there's no money. It costs £30,000 or £40,000 to keep each of these guys locked up. We also know from bitter past experience that when politicians talk tough, magistrates and judges listen to them and hand down longer sentences. So the budget's going to be more and more stretched. There'll be less resources
as Ken Clark knows all too well because he's tried it before, one of the kind of great unreformed areas of the public sector is prisons. And, down in the subtext of reporting was, more talk about private prisons and breaking the Prison Officers Association and that whole kind of agenda of kind of cutting the cost of keeping people in prison.
Madeline, scanning the leader columns of the tabloids yesterday, we found The Sun saying, Cameron had finally shown welcome steel. Do you think he was just appeasing the tabloids or do you agree with Anne? Do you think he was doing something a bit more subtle?
No, I don't buy the subtlety argument. I think what we're seeing more and more is something that people did talk about before he became Prime Minister, which is this kind of extraordinary ruthlessness. And he, above all, is a politician to his fingertips, Cameron. Everything he does is about political strategy. To my mind, it seems. So this is entirely designed for political advantage. And all of his kind of U-turns over the last few weeks have shown just an amazing ability to dump principle and close colleagues who he has backed up. He gave Kenneth Clark his backing until it looked like it was going to be a real liability for him politically, and he dumped him. So I see an incredible kind of ruthless political strategy at work, which, of course, is about keeping that tabloid constituency on side.
Do you think it's possible he went away and read, for example, the Daily Mail leader and thought, well, now there's less crime and there are more prisons, the two things go together, and so why not keep it?
Well, Cameron is cleverer than that. I'm not disputing the cleverness of the guy, and he knows there's no causal relationship between a drop in crime and these incredibly high prison population that the UK has had. You know, there are very good long-term reasons as to why the crime issue has crime has fallen over the last 15 years. Some of them are to do with technological innovations. White goods are much, much, much less valuable. You know, when you break into a house, what are you going to carry away that you can actually resell? There's far less incentive. Cars, for example, massively improved security on both cars and houses. So there are those kinds of technological innovation. And also, you know, we've been through a period of high, although it's obviously fallen, employment. But there's still, employment has not been hit as badly in this recession as some feared it might be. And that, you know, it's possible that crime figures might start to rise if unemployment really significantly rose. So, you know, the situation may change, but it's much more closely linked to economic indicators, the crime rate, than it is to the prison population. We know what happens with prison. It fails, you know. Reoffending rates are appallingly high. So prison doesn't work, and I don't think Cameron has ever been, you know, stupid enough not to know those arguments inside out.
Well, one person who certainly knows those arguments inside out, Julian, is Nick Clegg, and he was there chairing the cabinet committee that waved through the rehabilitation revolution. Apart from being in Brazil, he's gone a bit quiet now, though, hasn't he?
He has. I mean, I think the Lib Dems are less concerned by this so-called U-turning on sentencing than people would expect them to be, and for a good reason, which is that I think that the events of this week have dealt a bigger blow to the government's deficit reduction strategy than they have done to liberal sentencing ambitions. And I say that for a simple reason, which is that at the centre of the Ken Clark plan, now abandoned or heavily amended, was a desire to save £150 million, and that's what drove the policy. He wanted to reduce prison numbers, and hooray for him, shouted the Liberals. But you can still rehabilitate people within prison. There isn't quite the link that we're assuming between reducing the prison population and the rehabilitation revolution, as the Tories called it. The challenge now that the government has committed itself to maintaining, possibly even increasing the prison population, is to make sure that prison for the very first time does work, that within prison people are learning skills, being educated, being helped off drug and alcohol addiction and so on and so forth, being prepared for a life outside of the gates once released.
But we had this, didn't we? I mean, David Blunkett, of all people, in 2003 passed a criminal justice bill, and it was about, yes, we're going to lock up the really bad guys for twice as long as we do now, but then there'll be this other thing called Custody Plus, whereby people do work in the week and weekend prisons and so on, you know, all kind of same kind of language, get them off drugs, get them doing useful jobs, bloody blah. What ended up happening is that the budget got swallowed and overwhelmed by prison, didn't it? I mean, and prison population, as you'll know, has doubled over 20 years.
It does kind of make you think that prison itself and the way prisons are run probably does need some attention.
But, I mean, there's no... What I'm struggling to see in Julian's point is that surely you need money to invest.
You do, and this is why I say the biggest blow is to the deficit reduction strategy. It costs £30,000 or £40,000 to keep a single prisoner in jail. Yeah. If you're going to make prison work rather than simply use it for containment purposes, you probably need to double that figure if you're actually going to invest in rehabilitative services within prison.
But do you believe they will?
I don't, because I don't think they've got the money, and this is why I regret the decision. But if Cameron was true to his word in his press conference that he wanted to make prison work and he wanted to have a new approach to incarceration so that it wasn't just about punishment, it was also about rehabilitation, then great. But, you know, show me the money.
Well, let's just think for a moment about where Labour is on this, because Ed Miliband, of course, initially said that he was going to give Ken Clark space, but before long he was calling for Ken Clark's head. And yesterday he used Prime Minister's questions to raise some very obscure point, which was chosen purely to make him look tough on crime.
Now, instead of listening to the Home Secretary, why doesn't he listen to Angie Conway from Rape Crisis? This is what she says. With the reporting of rapes on the increase and conviction rates still shockingly low, the evidence this database provides is vital. The more of this data we hold, the more chance we have of catching rapists. She says this really is a no-brainer. Mr. Speaker, isn't this another policy on crime that is careless, not thought through, and out of touch? Why doesn't he think again?
First of all, if he actually understood the policy, he will know. Yes. If he understood the policy, he will know that the police are allowed to apply to keep DNA on the computer, not something that he mentioned.
And I spoke about this with our resident expert, Alan Travis, as well, and he says this really is a straightforward case where Miliband had it wrong and Cameron was right. Where the police need the DNA, they can appeal and they can hang on to it. Now, I think you can see, Anne, what's happening here. Labour thought it had got this amazing flank opening up where it could attack the government from the right on crime. And as that flank's closed down now with Cameron going all hard man, they think that they can that they need to open it up again by raising things like this. But aren't they wrong? Has any British general election ever been won on issues of law and order and crime?
Well, I think it's a very important mood shaper. I think actually Miliband's strategy is slightly different on that. I think he hoped to make Cameron look, as he rather successfully did on, for example, on the cancer figures last week and disability living allowance, that he didn't understand the detail of his policy, and I think that's what he hoped to achieve yesterday and at Prime Minister's questions and didn't necessarily succeed. And I mean, we discussed this in the studio before, but I don't think Miliband's swinging has really done him any favours, because he did say he was he wanted to give Ken Clark space and he liked the noises Ken Clark was making, and yet the moment Ken Clark's in trouble and the moment the Daily Mail starts shouting, you know, Ed's kind of switched back to the default position of all politicians. And I mean, this raises a kind of wider point about the what seems to me to be this kind of a really curious disconnect between the noises politicians feel they need to make and what they're actually doing, and how far they're successfully held to account for the difference between what they say and what they do, which is possibly something we may come on to in a little while.
Julian, I mean, the Liberal Democrats, you know, unusually really, of the political parties, have a long tradition of sort of arguing in a more nuanced way on issues to do with crime. Have you felt in working with them that that's been a big problem for them? Do you think that the
there is no alternative in the end to talking tough on crime, as seems to be happening this week?
Well, it's hard to judge Lib Dem's success and failure in a sense because their ambitions are different. If you have the ambition to govern on your own as a majority party, I don't doubt for a second that you cannot push a pure liberal approach to crime. I don't think you can sell that in this country. In a way, though, the Lib Dems have got different ambitions, and one of them is to maintain their distinctiveness, their identity as a liberal party, and therefore they feel, I think, emboldened to argue a case like on crime, like on Europe, which they know to be unpopular. Immigration is another example, where they're basically writing off a large chunk of the electorate, and in return for that they are at least doing what a liberal party should be doing, which is pushing liberal ideas.
Well, there's lots more on crime, of course, at guardian.co.uk/politics. But for the moment, put the new Bang 'em Up Dave out of your head and recall the old soft cheese Cameron who Boris Johnson was mocking at the start of the week. Because, Julian Ustall, you wrote in The Guardian this week that the Blairites, the Cameroons and the Orange Bookers in your own party were all liberals who have more in common with each other than with the parties that they're members of. Could you just explain what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I regret the fact that my article was published in this week of all weeks.
Yeah, unfortunately,
law and order is one of those areas, as we've just discussed, where liberalism is very much a minority sport. But across the rest of the domestic policy agenda, I think one of the most striking things about the current administration is the degree of continuity between its programme, the coalition agreement, and that pursued by the Blairites, particularly in the second and third terms. You look at schools reform, pushed energetically by Andrew Adonis and Tony Blair. You look at welfare reform, pushed by James Purnell. Across these areas, you see a desire to look beyond the state, to break up the state monopoly in public service provision, to decentralise power, to try to empower service users, a greater emphasis on diversity of provision and user choice. And there is a thread which links the policies of the Blairites, the Cameroonian Tories, and the sort of free market Lib Dems, known as the Orange Book Lib Dems. And that's what sort of led me to argue that in many respects, these three groups on the right of the Labour Party, the left of the Conservative Party, and within the Lib Dems have more in common with each other than they do perhaps with their own backbenchers.
And even if we accept that, you alluded to the fact it's maybe come somewhat unstuck on law and order, where they'd like to do something more constructive but don't feel they can. It's also come unstuck on the economic liberalism half of the equation, on the NHS, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, NHS is a little bit different, frankly. There are two types of issues for the current government. There are issues that they want people to be talking about and focusing on, and there are issues they absolutely don't want people to be focusing on and talking about. Crime and health, interestingly, are two issues they would rather go away, truth be told. You know, a measure of success on both law and order and on the health service will be if there is no crisis, if the issues disappear. That is the limit of their ambitions. But on things like schools reform, on welfare reform, and on the economy and deficit reduction, these are front foot issues. These are the issues where both parties within the coalition feel they have a bold, radical agenda for reform. They're happy to talk about it. They want the focus to be on that. And on those issues, I think the agenda is a small L liberal agenda. It's the one that Blair finally came round to. If you read his memoirs, he talks about how it took him far too long to recognise the limitations of the state bureaucracy at the centre to affect change on the ground in classrooms and so forth. And he finally came round to what I think is an impeccably liberal agenda, which is about looking beyond the state bureaucracy, looking beyond government targets, ministerial diktat, and trying to align incentives within these services to drive change from the bottom up. I think that's impeccably liberal. I think that's where David Cameron, Nick Clegg and Tony Blair before them all find themselves.
But Anne, would you say, when you remember that Beveridge and Keynes, for example, were liberals as well, if there is a common liberalism here, it's a particular type of liberalism?
Could you explain to me what you mean by that? I mean, I think because I think the subtext of your question is that you know, these are people who kind of promoted state action.
Mm.
And yet, in fact, if you remember, Beveridge wasn't at all keen on kind of state solutions. He wanted, and he certainly, for example, in any kind of welfare system, it felt it had to be insurance-backed, it had to be based on individual contribution in alliance with the state. I don't think he, and I'm sure not Keynes either, envisaged the state working as the state came to work, arguably under the influence of people like Bevan.
But it's pretty hard to imagine Keynes celebrating this very tough policy on the deficit as being a kind of liberal.
No, indeed not. No, as Robert Sklodowsky regularly reminds us, as Keynes is kind of spokesman in the afterlife.
I think part of the problem here is that liberalism is the most baggy term imaginable, and that, you know, you can have plenty of very long conversations trying to define what liberalism is, and it's like a sort of scrap in the centre of a very long-running political battle where everybody wants a chunk of liberalism and they want to define it. I don't think one can disagree at all with Julian's argument about continuity. Mm. I think that's absolutely right. I think to describe it as liberal takes it into that very complicated political argument about what liberalism is. But the idea that all three political parties have strong constituencies which are about dismantling traditional welfare state structures is absolutely right. What worries me really is how disconnected that kind of political consensus is from many other political constituencies around the country. It's like there's an elite group that have embarked on a political project which only connects with the voters at certain key points. And interestingly, crime and health, you're saying actually those are issues that the government wishes would just go away. Those are the issues that the electorate are going to come back to again and again and again. They're so visceral and sort of emotional. And I think that this liberal, which you could describe as liberal project, some might describe it as a neoliberal project, which is a dismantling state structures. I'm not sure that people feel the alternative offers them security. So I think people feel very caught in uncertainty over that.
But I think one of the reasons for that, one of the kind of curious things that's happened over the last sort of 50 or 60 years, and maybe also one of the reasons why there is this kind of commonality of outlook at the centre, is that, I certainly think there's a lot in the argument that for all the strengths of having a strong central state, you do also disempower kind of local bodies through which people might once have felt confident in organising their own affairs. And how you re-establish that, if it's possible to re-establish that, is one of the kind of biggest challenges in politics, and one the politicians are finding extremely hard to handle, because of course every time they kind of want to let things go, they kind of think, oh my god, what if it doesn't work, and get hold of it again. And at the same time, you know, they're kind of busily, for example, you know, doing a lot of things that completely disempower what's left of local government, for example. So they're really floundering in how you kind of reconstruct genuine pluralism.
Do you want to come in on this decentralisation point and whether it's liberal?
I mean, people talk about decentralisation in the abstract. I think what really drives this are the technical problems that come up if you don't decentralise power. I mean, as any private sector organisation will tell you, and you look at the NHS, how massive it is, and yet it is still run from the top, from the centre, you know, where a Secretary of State in Whitehall is directly accountable for an MRSA bug in a hospital ward in Kent. I mean, it's just a crazy way to run any organisation. And you know, what you find is that the idea that ministers can sit in Whitehall with a 300-mile screwdriver trying to micromanage services all around the country has been shown to fail. I mean, that is a model of governance which I think was tested to destruction under New Labour. I think Blair himself came to realise that they had tested it to destruction. He writes about the frustration he felt. You know, they were pouring money in, and yet every time they pulled a lever in Whitehall, they realised it just wasn't attached to anything. Nothing was happening. They couldn't affect real change on the ground. So this isn't really about a clash of ideologies and all the rest of it. It comes down an awful lot to just to the technical issue of how within big bureaucracies, big organisations, you affect real meaningful change. And the answer that David Cameron, Nick Clegg, Tony Blair all came to, I think, it's about incentives. You have to empower people who use services, give them choice, give them voice, and you have to empower professionals on the front line, because it is in the relationship between the two that you find the difference between a good service and a bad service.
And so, I mean, you're arguing that that makes sense as a response to kind of Fabian failure and target-led failure, if you like, and agree with that. But what do you make of Madeline's point about how the public don't buy this, and also what Anne was saying earlier about how some of the problems in our politics at the moment arise because there is a sense in which the people at the top have an agenda that they're not prepared to argue for openly?
I agree with Madeline. I think that there is, the way our political system is, party political system is currently structured, doesn't really represent naturally the views that are out there. If you were to start from scratch, and this is really the sort of insight I was trying to offer in my article this week, you would have a centrist liberal party, and Tony Blair, Nick Clegg and David Cameron would all be in it. You would then have a proper conservative party with the usual conservative themes of tax cutting, tough on law and order, defence, anti-Europeanism and so forth. And you would have a proper left of centre, social democratic, dare we say, socialist party. The problem is that this grouping in the middle, who describe themselves within their own parties as modernisers, Tory modernisers, Lib Dem modernisers, Labour modernisers, should actually be in the same party.
Can you see it happening, Anne?
Well, I think the one of the problems with politics, and I think in some ways that what Julian's describing is a kind of subset of what Peter Oborn wrote about a few years ago, very persuasively, about the kind of emergence of a kind of political class that's separate from ordinary people and ordinary voters, is the way political parties themselves are structured. And I was thinking, you know, when I first started being interested in politics, I remember that not only did Labour have this kind of raucous and ultimately rather unsatisfactory method of devising policy and debating policy, the Conservatives had an incredibly well-established system of local political discussion groups, and there'd be sent out material to debate, and there'd be sent out forms to comment on it, and they'd be all marshalled back into central office, and they would be read.
But
and
ignored, they would inform, were they?
No, they wouldn't be ignored, ultimately, I don't think. Maybe, well,
they
I
never
don't know
brought
enough
back
about
hanging, did they?
Yeah. I don't expect they've ever supported for example, Ted Heath, but I do think that there was a, and you know, and the Liberals kind of come closest to kind of supporting to continuing that tradition, arguably because their kind of policies making structures haven't been tested by power quite so much. And you can't just do managerial politics. People have to feel that they're operating in a kind of political context, and then they have to understand what that is. And there is no real political activity going on, you know, away from Westminster. I mean, of course there is. Sorry, that's a wildly sweeping generalisation. But there needs to be much, much more at a much lower level, and people, you know, need to be engaged in the sense that there is a political world that is separate just from their local hospital, just from their school.
I think that it's interesting because Compass has got their conference this coming weekend. So, you know, they are trying to sort of have something of that debate about Labour's renewal and what it might consist of and so forth. But I think, you know, they're even aware of how sort of becalmed political debate is. It seems to have kind of got caught in a sort of stasis. And, you know, the thing that I think has really struck me this week is a line from Aditya Chakraborty's comment reporting on Greece, which is that the economic crisis in Greece has led to a completely sort of violent rejection of anything mainstream, whether it's politics, business, economy, the media as well. Mainstream has become a term of abuse. Now, we're a long, long way away from Greece. We're not facing a crisis like that. But I don't think it's that hard to imagine, because already we do see tones of this, that somehow mainstream has become a word of abuse. The media get it, you know, mainstream media. But actually, what we're just talking about now, about a kind of liberal political elite, which is stuffed to the gills with very clever, very smooth operating middle class males, you know, that just doesn't represent, you know, sort of anybody. I mean, people watch these kind of identikit political leaders and think, you know, there's nothing here that I can connect with these people. And I think, you know, that a sort of reaction against mainstream politics is you know, a really worrying trend.
And Julian, do you think, as well as just the personnel of this new liberalism, there's a problem with the policy too, if you think in terms of what the public who might be stuck in crap jobs or worried they won't have any job at all and worried about community breakdown, can sort of liberal and individualistic solutions really have much to say to them, do you think?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't equate liberalism with individualism. I think that is unfair. It does the same thing to liberalism as is done when you just attach the word neo to it, which is a favourite device of its opponents. I mean, here's the issue about the way our politics is conducted. Because the three parties are all chasing the same floating voters and can take for granted their course all-weather support, they end up converging on the ground where those floating voters are to be found. I mean, you know, we've got 30 million voters in this country, and it varies a bit election to election, but normally about 500,000 of them decide who's going to win. Those are voters who, first of all, have to live in a swing marginal constituency, and second of all, have to be swing voters themselves, haven't made up their minds. And so all the efforts of the political parties are put in, you know, as if they were a company marketing a product, to trying to appeal to that group of people. And that is why we have this depressingly narrow debate, and why so many people feel effectively disenfranchised and alienated from the discussion. Now, you know, what's the solution to that? Voting reform, and that's gone for a generation. But nonetheless, the cause of the problem, the narrowing of our politics around the centre ground, is nonetheless explained by that structural problem.
Well, having drawn a narrow line around our politics, we're going to draw a line around our own proceedings now. And you can leave your comments on any of today's issues at guardian.co.uk Politics Weekly, which is our blog. And we'll be back next week. But for now, many thanks to Julian Astle, to Madeline Bunting and to Anne Perkins. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.